I'm Tom Edwards and welcome to the first Monocle Arts Review of the year to get things started. In 2017, we're going to be looking at the art shows that Jane Morris, editor-at-large of the art newspaper, is looking forward to this year. Welcome to the show. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
I should begin by saying the first thing to talk about is Russia. Perhaps predictably, it's obviously 100 years since the Russian Revolution this year. One imagines plenty of galleries and museums are going to be celebrating, marking the occasion around the world, including the Royal Academy and the Tate here in London, at MoMA in New York. How are these various institutions marking the occasion? I know we're going to zero in on one in particular.
Yes, I mean, I'm really particularly looking at the London shows for this edition. And the Royal Academy is going to kick us off with a show focusing on 1917 to 1932. So basically the first 15 years after the revolution. Now, Monocle listeners, I'm sure, will know there were actually two revolutions. The first one in February, when the Tsar was deposed, and then the second one in October, when the Bolsheviks took power. And of course, that was actually using the old calendar. So really, it's March and November, but that's just being slightly pedantic.
It's important to get the detail right, though.
Absolutely.
Jane, I appreciate that.
So basically, February, the Royal Academy is going to look at this period, which was something of a golden age in Russian art. Basically, under the Tsars, the work that was produced was very sort of academic and, you know, rather classical and rather dry. So as the revolution, the year of revolution starts, a lot of artists feel that they've suddenly got a great deal more freedom. Mm-hmm. And for many people, this is a very exciting period. And what the Royal Academy is going to look at is the fact that lots of different kind of art was being made. So you've got people like Malevich, very sort of classic modernist, you know, he makes the famous black square picture. So you've got people who are really abstract, really geometric. And maybe at the other end of the scale, you've got people like Chagall who are more romantic, they are figurative, they're using dreams and they're trying to add sort of, they're trying to bring Russian folk tales into a kind of modern style of painting. And then, of course, you have people who are thinking about how art can be made socially useful. So you've got the constructivists who look quite a lot like Malevich and his suprematists, but actually are doing an entirely different project, really. And even into the very early sort of social realist painters. So it's a really, really exciting time. Unfortunately, in 1932, when Stalin comes to, well, Stalin is now in power, firmly in power, he decides that the only useful art is socialist realist art. And he bans quite a lot of work. So Malevich is amongst the artists who are banned. Others basically find that although their work isn't exactly banned, life is very uncomfortable for them. Quite a lot of them move out of Russia, head to France. Some even end up in the United States because, of course, some of them are unfortunate enough that they move to France and then the Nazis appear and don't like them either. And little by little, people make it to America. So this show is really about this kind of fantastic 15 years when people were being very creative, very expressive, trying out lots and lots of different kinds of art. And I think what's very special about it is it's actually based, apparently, the concept of the show is to base it on an exhibition that happened in the State Russian Museum in Leningrad, which is now St. Petersburg. And they've taken that, and I think that show was in 1933, they've taken that as the starting point. Some rooms are going to be recreated, and the rest of it, as I say, will be looking back on this golden period just before it was basically, the candle was snuffed out and everything became socialist realist. And that
was that. It's interesting, Jane, what strikes me as interesting, and I sort of alluded to this at the top of the show, is this idea that you have a big event, a big anniversary, and you've got others, you know, we have Red Star over Russia coming to Tate Modern.
Yeah, November.
It's quite competitive then, aren't they? And a lot of these spaces, which we know very well, they must try and get one up on each other. Do you think that the sort of ruse here from the Royal Academy, which is to peg this to that event at the time and see how looking at it through that prism helps. I mean, that's a good way of trying to stand out from the competition, I guess. But that's what these big spaces, still, they need to do that, don't they? They need to be mindful that they won't be alone at zeroing in on this at this time.
I think if you went to talk to any of the loans departments in any of the big museums, they are quite aware competitively who's trying to borrow what and when. And I think it's quite interesting that the Tate has waited till the end of the year. And I think that is because they want to get certain loans. And with MoMA running a show now and with the Royal Academy opening next month, I think that there's obviously been some pressure over loans. What's interesting though with the Royal Academy show, they've borrowed a great deal from Russia, and that's in itself is quite unusual. So a lot is coming from the Tretyakov in Moscow and other things coming from the State Russian Museum in St. Petersburg. So a lot of this work doesn't travel very often, which will be very interesting. It's a funny time, though, because the museums are obviously quite excited about this period. It's a very important period in modern art history. And it's probably the only time where Russia is this important until maybe the 80s, 90s. But of course, there's a very interesting article in The Guardian last month, which was talking about the fact that Putin doesn't know quite what to do about this because he doesn't want to sort of promote the idea of revolution. So how the museums inside Russia are going to mark this year, we're waiting to see.
And we'll find out. It'll be most interesting. Well, a litany of shows to reel off. Revolution Russian Art 1917 to 32 is taking place at the Royal Academy from the 11th of February to the 17th of April. The Tate Modern Show runs until February 18th. And a revolutionary impulse is on at the moment until March 12th. Now, Jane, let's move on. We've just discussed one show that's on at the Tate Modern, albeit briefly, but later on this year, they're switching their focus to black art. Soul of a Nation is the title. It will look at how black art was defined, rejected and redefined by artists across the US. Jane, tell us about this one. Why has this made your list of one to watch for this year?
There's a pretty important trend going on at the moment of rewriting modern and contemporary art history. And I think, you know, on various shows, we've touched on this. And I see this show very much as part of that. I think it was quite interesting that at the last Venice Biennale, in Okwe Enwazor's show, there was an amazing amount of work by African-American artists. The interesting thing is that amongst contemporary artists, you know, if you think about people like Rashid Johnson and Mark Bradford is going to be representing the US at this year's Venice. If you think about contemporary artists, I think they are now, African-Americans are now totally in the mainstream. But what's happening is, because of their success, partly, and partly because of this interest in looking back at art history, people are beginning to talk a lot more about artists from the 60s, 70s and early 80s, who are mostly people that most of your listeners, and actually a lot of the art world, will never have heard of. And I'm thinking of names like Jack Whitton, Melvin Edwards, Sam Gilliam. They're beginning to be better known inside America. They're not well known outside. And the Tate is going to do this major, major show focusing on these artists. It's quite a big step, I think, for the Tate to focus so much on this new kind of American art history. And I think that we're seeing this as part of a sort of ongoing trend. There is going to be a touring exhibition that starts at the end of this year in the States. I think it's starting in New Orleans, which is going to be about black abstract expressionist artists, abstract artists, again, from the 60s and 70s, which is expected to tour across America into 2018. So I see this very much as part of an ongoing trend. And I think if people are interested in the way that art history is changing, this is going to be one of those exhibitions that's going to be written and talked about a lot.
And Jane, it's interesting. You make that point there that this show focuses on art between 63 and 83. And this was a time of incredible social revolution as much as artistic revolution. And not just in the US, but more globally. But one imagines that will be a narrative coupled with this fresh interest in looking back now that they'll be trying to reflect in the show.
I think the idea is to look first, the 63 is very much the era of the civil rights movement, and a group called the Spiral Group formed. It didn't last very long, but it formed, and a number of artists were thinking about how they might contribute to the civil rights movement and what it meant to be an artist. That morphs more into the kind of more militant, I suppose, black power movement. And to some extent, one of the reasons that some of these artists are not so well known now, although, as I say, they've influenced people like Mark Bradford a lot. So I think black American artists, contemporary artists, are very aware of them, but the rest of us less so, is that a lot of artists didn't really know what to do with the position of being black and maybe or maybe not an activist. So the abstract artists kind of fell out of political favour. And then you get other people like the Afro-Cobra movement, which is a Chicago-based movement. I think it started in around 68. And they very quickly began to feel that making painting or, you know, making art and putting it in galleries was irrelevant. So they got much more interested in doing pamphlets and posters and murals. So you've got different things going on. You know, there were black artists who didn't conform to what a black artist should be, which is possibly figurative, obviously political. And then you've got others who move out of the art world entirely, pretty much, and want to engage much more at a community level. So that show is going to look at some of these tensions and debates. So both what the outside world thought and also some of the politics and debates that were going on amongst African-American artists themselves.
Now, one artist that doesn't feature, and we'll talk about him actually briefly before the end of the show, is Jean-Michel Basquiat, but we'll come back to him. But Soul of a Nation, Art in the Age of Black Power is on at Tate Modern from 12th of July through till the 22nd of October. Jane, this year sees the return of the Sculpture Project, which I've said in a sort of only, in a fully English way with no Germanic twang, but it's in Munster, and it takes place only every 10 years and looks at, well, the interesting relationships, the complexities of art, public space, the urban environment, I guess you could call it. Why does this only happen once per decade, Jane, first of all?
I think probably because it's a hugely expensive project.
That would be one of the main reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I think it costs about 15 million or 20 million euros, or maybe it's a little less than that. Anyway, it has a huge budget. It's not as vast as Documenta's budget, but it's got a really big budget. Basically, in the mid-70s, Munster is in North Rhine-Westphalia, so it's a wealthy part of Germany. But it's very conservative, it's medieval city, it does have a university. And in the 70s, the city, I believe, tried to erect a couple of sculptures, one by George Rickey and one by Henry Moore. And it caused absolute outrage, which gives you an idea of how conservative the town was. And this slightly appalled the then director of the main museum there. He co-opted another young curator called Caspar Koenig, who is still curating this every 10-year event. And they started doing a series of sort of lectures and talks in a hope of sort of encouraging the public to like this modern sculpture a bit more. And in 77, they decided to do the first sort of site-specific festival of sculpture. I mean, to be honest, they did probably the 77 one and the 87 one was still pretty controversial and caused quite a lot of fuss. This is the fifth version now, been going so 50 years. And now the city absolutely loves it. It brings nearly a million people to visit. The city is now seen as much more contemporary and go ahead. And what it's done, which is quite interesting, is not only do they commission about 30, 35 projects, they've started buying some each decade. So basically, there are now around 30 permanent works, which are like a sort of history of large site-specific sculpture. Plus, you get to see the 30 or so new projects. And some of them are really kind of quite exciting. So a few years ago, a Turkish artist called Aysa Erkmen, she tried to put sculptures around the cathedral. And the cathedral kept rejecting, you know, every sort of suggestion. This is when it was still pretty controversial. And so she ended up basically hanging a load of sculptures off a helicopter and hanging them in the air above the cathedral. Now, those days have sort of calmed down a bit, but she's going to do this bridge. It sounds absolutely beautiful. She's going to do it. It's apparently just going to be a few inches below the water across the harbour. So it'll be invisible, this bridge. But then you take your shoes off and you walk across it. So the only way you're going to see it is by people walking across it. And it's going to look like some kind of pilgrim ritual, you washing your feet. But it sounds great. And there's going to be quite a few things like that. So although I'm mostly doing London, and although it's a Venice year and a Documenta year, I still think if you can only go and see one thing, why not hop over to Munster? Because it's not terribly expensive to get there. It's not a terribly expensive city. And I think you'll just have a sort of very exciting time seeing about 60 sort of amazing sculptures.
It sounds wonderful.
Really big.
Sculpture Project Munster is on from the 10th of June until the 1st of October. And here's hoping that actually that the warmth with which it's viewed locally reflects changing views, not just the fact that after 50 years it's outlasted some of the most cantankerous and miserable people who were there, but who knows, maybe it's a bit of both. Time is short, Jane. Let's end, as promised though, by mentioning what I was surprised to see is the first large-scale exhibition in the UK of work by Jean-Michel Basquiat, because you kind of think, well, it must have been before. But no, this is it. Basquiat Boom for Real is on at the Barbican starting in September. Died in the late 1980s and known, I guess, for that period, really through the 70s and 80s. Most people know him. Why has there not been a large-scale show until now?
Well, I'm hesitant to say hey, I have absolutely no idea, because I sort of do have absolutely no idea. They do keep saying as well that there's none of his work in any British collections. And to some extent, that really is because he was born in 1960. He died in 88 of a drug overdose. He was a massive superstar, probably from the age of 21, 22. So because he became so successful so quickly, so young, basically his prices rocketed. So even American museums have really had to wait for people to donate them. Most museums pretty much missed the curve, and he got too expensive for them to buy. And then, of course, by the time he died at 28, he was prolific, but that's not a very long career. So basically, there's not much supply effectively. And the prices are absolutely enormous now. I mean, I think the top price for him at the moment is $57 million for a painting that he made in 82 when he was 22 years old. So, I mean, he's an interesting guy. He was a massive self-publicist. I'm sure quite a lot of your listeners are aware of him, but for those who aren't, basically, he was a very, very handsome black guy. He very much played on the idea that he was an outsider graffiti artist. He was actually very well educated, middle class. He spoke a lot of languages. And as anyone who looks at his art can see, while there are sort of references to graffiti and, you know, pop culture and music, he's got a very solid grounding in modern art. And, you know, there's a lot of references. As his first, well, his main dealer, Bruno Bischofsberger, always used to note, you know, there's a lot of relationship there between people like Dubuffet, Paul Klee, even Matisse, some people see references to. He was a very, very, very accomplished artist, and he was very accomplished very young. Plus, he knew how to publicise himself. So he would be hanging around in Armani, you know, painting nightclubs, looking gorgeous. He was friends with Andy Warhol. He led a pretty gilded life. Unfortunately, 1980s New York was also absolutely awash with heroin, absolutely awash with cocaine. It was heroin that did for him, as far as I recall. And so he had this brilliant, glittering career. And I thought what was so sad thinking about it was I was talking about Mark Bradford a bit earlier. And of course, I realised that Mark Bradford and he are the same age. So they were born the same year. Bradford has only really become famous in the past 10 years. And you know, Basquiat now feels like he belongs to an entirely different generation, entirely
That's
different
extraordinary
era.
To think that they're contemporaries. And do we know what will be on show, as you said, given the sort of relative, not scarcity exactly, but the fact that it's trickier for museums to get hold of this stuff? Can we just speculate, or do we have any sense of what we might looking forward to looking at?
The Barbican is promising us some really stellar loans. I mean, there is a little bit of indication of some of the paintings. We're told that there really will be a great set from 81 or 82. He had a show at PS1, which I think was 81. And I believe that they're going to recreate that show. Well, it was a group show, but he had a sort of room in it. So I think the idea there is that we're going to get a real sense of just how good he was that young. And it's not common that, actually. I know we talk about people like Damien Hirst and co, but most people aren't really making their best work until they're in their mid-30s, even late 30s. So to be this accomplished this young is unusual.
And you can see some of the extraordinary works. Who knows? Treasures from as early as 81 and 82 at Basquiat, Boom for Real, which is on in September until January 2018 at the Barbican. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Jane, so much to look forward to.
It's going to be a great year this year, I think. There's a lot of really great shows on. I mean, I could have picked another sort of 10 in London alone, and we didn't even scratch the surface of New York.
So we'll have to have you back and find out more art. Maybe we'll do it on a region-by-region basis. Yeah. That's a good way of chalking everything off. That's the end of today's show. Jane Morris, thanks for being with us. As always, this is the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. The show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. We'll be talking music, but for now it's goodbye from me. Thank you for listening.